From the Draco Vista Studios in Phoenix, Arizona, unlocking secrets of writing, conversing with masters of the craft, and just having a lot of fun. It's the Dragon Page, cover to cover.
Hey, welcome everyone to another Dragon Page. I am Michael R. Menengay.
And I am Michael Stackpole.
And we have a real treat today. Joining us on the phone is the one and only Kevin J. Anderson, friend of ours, and we love to have him on the show.
That's right.
He's got a new book out that is called The Dark Between the Stars, and it's being called A Game of Thrones with Planets, and that intrigued the hell out of me, so we've got to talk about that. Thanks for joining us, Kevin.
Well, good to see you guys again. We've known each other for, well, Mike and I have known each other longer than the printing press was invented.
But, I mean, Mike Stackpole
and Mike Menengo, we've known you since...
Jeez, who knows?
Who knows? We've been around too long. I don't want to make it sound like the old fart club because we're still young and vivacious and all that.
Yes, we are. Absolutely. And hair coloring is not a vice. It's a virtue.
That's right.
Hair? Who has hair?
What's this hair thing he's talking
about? I glue mine on every morning.
Yeah. Good thing it's radio.
There we go.
That's right. So talk
okay,
to
that's
us.
What I stopped everything.
We were all checking our hair.
That's right, yeah.
Well, the last time I was on the Dragon Page, Brian Herbert and I had just had, I think it was Sisterhood of Dune or Hellhole or something out.
Oh, yeah.
I remember very clearly because we were on a book tour for it, and we were in between like a TV show thing,
mm-hmm.
and we had just checked into the hotel, and we had a book signing that night, and we had a very narrow window of time, and trying to figure out how to call in to you guys when we were in two separate hotel rooms. But I remember very clearly that I was sitting on the floor in my hotel room next to the bed with one phone, and Brian was off at the desk with the other phone, and we had called in, and we were doing our interview, and basically we said our stuff, and we just sort of rushed you off because we had to change clothes and run off to our book signing. So we're a little more relaxed this time.
Well, there you go.
A little bit more, yes.
I've got my shoes off and everything and hanging around in my own office. So
all right,
that's the place to be.
Well, talk to us about this new book because it sounds fascinating. You're finally getting back to your series, it looks like.
Yeah, I did. Several years ago, I wrote what I consider like my masterpiece or my love letter to science fiction. It was a 7-volume epic called The Saga of Seven Suns, where mm-hmm. it all these planets, all these characters, it's like War and Peace and Shogun and everything with alien races and planets. And somebody compared the whole thing, including this new one, which is a new trilogy, the whole thing to like a Game of Thrones with planets. And I was quick to point out that it's not exactly like a Game of Thrones with planets because my books came out every year on time and the whole series is done. So The Saga of Seven Suns, it's 7 volumes, it's all out in paperback, it's all done, and the story ended. It was a completely finished thing. And I've been away from that universe for about 5 years now, but I had always, when I wrote the first one, I planted seeds to do, not really a sequel trilogy, it's more like a next generation thing 20 years later with a bunch of new characters, but it's the universe that I created. And when you spend like 8 years of your life creating this huge universe with all these cultures and races and settings, you kind of want to go back and visit it sometime. So with The Dark Between the Stars, I was able to return with this story that I planted all the seeds in the first 7 books. It wasn't one of those where, gosh, this was successful, let's milk another story out of it. This was always planned to do another trilogy in it. But wow, the things you forget after 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And having written 7 books in a row, all of that stuff was in my head. But then I went on and wrote a huge fantasy trilogy with sailing ships and sea monsters, and I wrote like 3 or 4 more Dune books with Brian Herbert, and we wrote our entire Hellhole trilogy, and I wrote a steampunk novel with the rock band Rush, and I've written a bunch of comics and a whole series of Dan Shamble zombie PI humorous horror things. So that all crowded out all of the details that I remembered about The Saga of Seven Suns. And I say that they were all crowded out with all this extra stuff, but it's not because I'm getting older and just forgetting where I put my car keys. That may be part of it. But so I had to spend almost a year just re-uploading everything from the the first series of books. And the strange thing that readers don't understand is when I'm writing a book, what I remember is what I put down on the paper. But over the course of editing things, that there may have been somebody who changed a character name or an event got rewritten, and all I remember is what I originally put down.
Mm-hmm.
So the things that are in my head aren't necessarily the things, it's not a huge amount of rewriting, but there are lots of little details of, oh, I forgot we changed the name of that character somewhere along the line. And just trying to remember all of this stuff and juggling it. But The Dark Between the Stars, it sets a new trilogy, and if you read the previous series, you'll find some familiar characters. But I intentionally wrote it so you didn't have to go back and read or reread seven books just to start page one. It's like classic Star Trek and Next Generation Star Trek. It's, if you like Star Trek, you like them both, but you don't have to know one or the other to enjoy both series. And just starting it, and the odd thing is with this one is because it took so long to ramp up on it, and because I got distracted with lots of other trips and other book deadlines and things, I kind of ran into a wall where I found out that I had to deliver the finished book of this 800-page manuscript in about 2 months. And so I buckled down, and I'm a pretty fast writer, as both of you guys know, and I had outlined it. There were like 138 chapters, and I was all ramped up because I had reread everything. I had the outlines, I had the characters, I was ready to go. And I just pushed the retro rockets button, and I wrote that entire 800-page book in 47 days.
Wow. That's amazing.
And
yeah.
I had to go off. I write with a recorder, a digital recorder, so I love to go hiking. I live in Colorado, and we've got all these great mountain trails and hiking trails. And I took a week to go off to Capitol Reef National Park in southern Utah, which is all canyons and deserts and weird rock formations. And I got a little lodge room, and I was all by myself, and I would just go out all day long and write chapters, and then I'd email them to my typist, and I'd spend all night long editing the ones that she sent me from the couple days before, and go out the next day and write like six more chapters, and then come back in and edit a bunch more chapters at night. That's what we writers do for fun, because we have no social lives. But I did get the book done.
Wow.
That's cool. Now, I'm facing the same sort of thing that you are. I've got a novel that I need to do a sequel to, and I wrote the original novel 26 years ago. When you went back and you said you reread everything and re-uploaded it, how much actual, you know, sit down making notes did you do? I mean, in the past for me, I've actually gone through and indexed books. Did you go that deeply, or was it literally just uploading and holding it in your mind for the amount of time that it took you to write this?
Well, I discovered when I was in college that I absolutely, totally suck at taking notes. I have no patience for it. I don't organize them well, and I basically just have to stuff it all in my head and hope that it's there. Although now I have an advantage in that the original series of seven books was so popular that I have a lot of fans of the series. So you can tap into the fan mind, and sure, if you don't remember something, and go, hey guys, did these two characters ever meet over the course of the seven books? And post that on Facebook, and it takes something like 7.3 seconds before somebody comes
exactly
back with the answer.
Yeah, yeah.
And so whenever I had doubts or I wasn't sure of something, I was able to get an answer for it. But I tried to make it far enough apart that I wasn't, you know, I don't want to write this new book and spend all these paragraphs where a character remembers the events from one of the previous novels.
Sure, sure.
Because, you know, if you read the previous novels, you remember it. And if you didn't read the previous novels, you get annoyed because I'm talking about something that you don't know. So I try to make it as standalone as possible, but still, as the author of the original series, you've done this, Mike Stackpole, that when you write like five-book series and you get these writers or readers who tell you, yeah, I just read book four and loved it, and now I'm going to read the other ones, and you
yeah
just want to tear whatever's left of your hair up. We, of course, planted all these beautiful seeds, and you can't read them out of order, but readers are much more resilient than I think writers realize, and they dive into it and pick it right up. And if you do make a mistake, somebody will tell you, usually after publication, but somebody will tell you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're very good and very generous with their time and explaining to you why you were wrong.
Yeah. Well, we could start talking Star Wars, but we don't
want to. We won't go there. So this is going to be a trilogy. And yes. Are you looking at one book a year, or are you going to go the George Martin route and just, you know, kind of goof around for a couple of years and then play with toy soldiers and then, you know, do the second book and so on and so forth?
Yeah, if I did it that way, I'd have to re-upload the thing every time I started writing it. Just this morning, I finished chapter 87 out of 118 in book two, and I expect to finish writing my first draft of it by the end of this month, and then I will blitz through the editing for a couple of months and deliver it probably in September, and Tor will bring it out in, I think, this time next year, probably June of next year. And I do, because each one of these volumes ends on, like, Luke, I am your father, big multiple storylines, all on a cliffhanger, all kinds of big explosions and everything, I don't feel that it's right for me to make the fans wait for 3 years. That's I'm the writer. I have a contract with the reader, not just with the publisher. I've got a contract with the reader that if I say here's a series that I want you to read, then I better deliver the next one on time. And you know, if I get a car accident or death of a family or something, there's legitimate excuses. But if I hired a contractor to redo my kitchen countertops and he was 5 years late finishing it up, I wouldn't hire that contractor again. And if I'm a reader picking up book one of a series, I believe that it's my obligation as a writer to deliver the next book on time. And all writers have their muse who gives them inspiration. And my muse is a union worker who comes in and punches the time clock every day on time. And and I get my ideas when I'm supposed to.
Awesome. Sure, sure.
So talk to us a little bit about your writing process. I know we've had this conversation in the past, but that's been a long, long time ago. So let's revisit it again, because you write a little different than other writers. You actually dictate most of your books.
Yes. I outline all of my books very heavily. The 118 chapters in Blood of the Cosmos is the second book of this trilogy. And like I said, it was like 138 chapters in The Dark Between the Stars. I outline them very carefully. In fact, my outline for Dark Between the Stars was like 89 pages long. So it's almost like the length of a novel that some other people might write. But I have it so that I know exactly what's going to happen. And my comparison to that is, if you're going to build a big skyscraper and you hire an architect, you kind of want that architect to do a blueprint first rather than just digging holes and putting up walls and hoping that they come together somewhere in the end. So I do a detailed outline. And part of that is also because I've done a lot of collaborating with Brian Herbert and with my wife, Rebecca Mesta, and with Doug Beeson and other people. And if you're collaborating on a book, you both need to have the same blueprint, otherwise you're not going to be writing the same story.
Right.
So that's the first thing that I'll spend a lot of time, and that is where the creativity comes from. They're called pantser writers, the seat of the pants writers that just sit down and write and hope that it works. They claim that that's the creative part, where they make things up when they're writing. Well, I do the creative part too. I just do it ahead of time when I'm outlining. That's when everything's up in the air. I can do whatever I want. The characters can do whatever they want. And then once we get the pencil sketch done, then we put it in ink and it's ready to go. But I will have, my chapters are something like 3,000 words long, which to the layman is 9 pages, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
What I'll do is, in my outline, I have each chapter one, here's like a paragraph describing this is what happens in chapter one, and I'll mark what the point of view is, because I use multiple characters. And then chapter two, this happens, and it's from this person's point of view. And then chapter three, this happens. And I'll go out with my digital recorder, and I'll take those little scraps of paper with me, like one, each paragraph is on a separate little index card or piece of paper. And I go out walking. I mean, this morning I just walked around. There's a bike path by our house, so it's just a local. I went out and did that. But 2 days ago, I drove off to a state park and hiked 8 miles in the canyons and mountains around here. Tomorrow I'm going to be driving off to a place called Steamboat Springs. It's a beautiful mountain town. Mm-hmm. It's a resort. And I'm going to stay there for 5 days because I'm falling behind on this book and I want to get it done on time. and it's like a 6-hour drive. And what I'm going to be doing, so don't drive next to me on the freeway, I'll have my recorder in one hand and I have the notes. And as I'm driving for 6 hours, I will probably dictate at least 3 chapters on the drive up.
Do we have to put a disclaimer in here? Don't write and drive.
And you do know you can use it.
Yeah, don't try this. The little fine print that says "professional writer, do not try this at home." Right.
And you do know that with a Bluetooth headset in your smartphone, you could actually record without having to have it in your hands.
It's easy enough to do that. I have my own, it's a high-end Olympus digital recorder that has bells and whistles that I want to have on and stuff. And then, or what I'll be doing up at Steamboat Springs, I'll be doing one day, probably Sunday, I've got it set up that I'm going to be doing what I believe will be a 19-mile hike.
Wow.
And on that 19 miles, I'll probably end up doing 4 or 5 chapters as well. I get back and I upload the digital files and email them off to my typist. And I live in Colorado, like I said, and I've climbed all 54 of the 14,000-foot mountain peaks in the Rockies and dictating while I'm doing it. So my typist says sometimes when I'm doing a particularly difficult mountain, it sounds like she's transcribing an obscene phone call.
That's awesome.
And when the book comes out, there's an awful lot of sentences with a bunch of ellipses in the middle of them because there's so many gaps and gasps.
Sure. Wow.
But hey, I love hiking and I love writing, so this way I don't have to choose one or the other. I get to go out and do it. And I find it actually inspirational. It doesn't always correlate this way, but I've written a bunch of dune books in the great sand dunes in Colorado. So I'm stomping up the sand dunes while I'm describing Fremen setting up sandworm rides. And I did one of my Star Wars books where they're at the ice caps of Coruscant. And I was writing that while I was up in the snow in the Sierra Nevada mountains crunching along on snowshoes while I was writing about Han and Leia being on the polar ice caps. So it's cool when that sort of thing ties together. I wrote some of my Star Wars Jabba's Palace stuff while I was out in Death Valley where the Jabba's Palace scenes were actually filmed.
Right.
So sometimes just having that, being surrounded by it, is almost like you're commuting to work in that universe. Other times it's just an excuse to go for a really cool hike and get some work done at the same time.
So the interesting thing is that the technology has really evolved a lot. I mean, the text-to-speech and speech-to-text and Dragon Natural Speaking and so forth. Have you explored any of that stuff, or is this just what your comfort zone is and you don't want to deviate from what works?
Well, for me, there are several drawbacks to the things like Dragon Naturally Speaking, because I write Dune books and Seven Suns books, so to retrain, my glossaries are like 30 pages long at the end of the book, so to retrain them with all these weird terms and names and languages, that's hard, but I use a human typist. It's not that expensive, and that way the human typist knows where to put the punctuation in.
Mm.
For Dragon, you have to say all of the punctuation every time you're using it. And if you almost get into like a fugue state. If I'm hiking for my 19 miles and I'm in the middle of this universe and in my story and I'm just dictating away, it's a space battle or something, and I've got characters shouting over the comm systems and little snippets of dialogue back and forth, my human typist actually knows these are different people talking, and she knows to put a different paragraph return and start a new quotation mark.
It's that interpretation,
Yeah, Dragon would, or whatever voice word recognition it has, it would just show up as this giant block of text. And I hate doing cleanup work. To me, that's like using a machete trying to carve a path through the jungle. And the less cleanup work that I have to do, the better. And also, I've had a couple of, I use typing services too, but I have a couple of dedicated typists who are fans of mine, and they've read a bunch of things. And my current typist is a big fan of the Dan Chambell Zombie PI stuff, so she just loves getting new Dan Chambell stories that I send in, and she remembers the other ones, and she can make, but he did this in this other story, or she'll mention things that I don't remember. I wrote a book called Enemies and Allies, which was the first meeting of Batman and Superman in the 1950s during the Cold War, And I did my research, but I couldn't do all of the detailed stuff about life in the 1950s. But my other typist is actually, she does research for game show questions, and she does research for a living. And she knows everything about the 50s, and she knows everything about horses, so, which works great when I'm writing fantasy scenes because I don't know anything about horses. They're animals you jump on and ride. So when I'm doing a horse riding scene in like my Terra Incognita fantasy trilogy, I have my character get on it, and I just would say, Mary, describe the tack and saddles and everything that he's wearing because you'll get it right. And she loves doing that. She puts it in there. But the thing about Enemies and Allies, the 1950s thing, I had Lex Luthor, who is this weapons merchant secretly selling nuclear arms to Soviets as well as the U.S. And I'm describing Lex Luthor, and I said, Mary, you know exactly what kind of watch Lex Luthor would wear in the 1950s, so just put it in there. And she did. I've never heard of the kind of watch, but she did research, and she found out exactly the kind of watch that someone like Lex Luthor would wear in 1953.
Wow.
That's kind of cool stuff.
That is very cool.
That is very cool.
You got it. It's more than just getting the words down. It's actually having the support and the interpretation or the interpolation of what's going on. Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah, that is neat. Just to shift gears for half a second, why don't you go and talk a little bit about what you've been doing with WordFire and how that relates to both working with other authors and then, you know, doing shows and conventions.
Sure. I'm sure you've talked many times on the show before about the hurricane that's happening in the publishing world now.
Oh, yeah. Oh yes.
Everything's changing, and it was about 3 years ago, one of these life-changing events, which I don't know what sparked it, but I remember all night long, I was just lying awake, staring at the ceiling, going, oh my God, what am I going to do now? Because Borders had just gone out of business, advances from publishers were like collapsing, so they were a tenth of what they were years ago.
Right.
And I was like about to turn 50. I had a couple of multiple book contracts that were coming to the end. And I was staring at the ceiling thinking, the whole publishing world is collapsing. I felt like I had just invested all of my money in a chain of Blockbuster video franchises. And I thought, well, what's going to happen here? And I had been talking with you, Mike Stackpole, a couple of years before that you were starting to get into doing your own PDF copies of books and uploading some of your old books. And what had stalled me was that I was looking at my ebook sales on my royalty sheets from my regular publishers. Like my Dune ebook royalties, that's like, oh boy, in 6 months a bestseller like Dune would sell 200 ebook copies. And I was thinking, well, this is just more trouble than it was worth. And I had one of my writing students, who's a fairly well-known horror writer now, Scott Nicholson, just said, Kevin, you should just put up some of your old backlist and see what happens. So he, for like nothing, $25 or something like that, he just put up a couple of my old first novels that were out of print forever and ever, and we just put them up on Kindle, and then I started getting these checks, and I went, holy cow, this is not chump change. And we started adding more books, and my first novel, Resurrection Inc., which came out in 1988, I got paid like $4,000 for it from the major publisher, Signet Books, and it never earned its $4,000 back, and it went out of print. And I put my version up, and it made more than $4,000 like in a year.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, whoa, this is not what I was told before. So we started rapidly. I had my rights back on a whole lot of my old titles, and I started putting them up. Because all these fans, and I've got, I think, 23 million books in print now for my guesstimate of all the things that I've got. So I've got a lot of fans out there, and they keep telling me that they just found an old battered book of mine in the used bookstore because that's the only place they could get it. Well, heck, if they're buying it in used bookstores, they might as well buy my version of it. So I started putting up all of my old backlist, and it was doing reasonably well. I mean, we're not talking millions of dollars, but we're certainly talking, you know, pay the car payment every once in a while and pay the mortgage every once in a while. And otherwise, it was earning me no money at all. It was just books gathering dust on the shelf, so why not bring them out there? And right around that time, we were Brian Herbert and I were complaining that a lot of Frank Herbert's old books, he wrote a lot of other books, like 21 books, and only six of them were Dune books. And everything else was out of print except for Dune. And so we started twisting our publisher's arm, Tor, saying, well, you're doing so well with the Dune books, why don't you reprint some of Frank's old stuff? And they picked like five or six of the titles and said fine, and they published them, so those came back out. But they weren't interested in the rest of his backlist. And Brian Herbert was looking at the books I was publishing of my own, and he said, well, why don't you publish them, Kevin? So we have a generous deal with our authors that we split the royalties on way better terms than New York publishers do. And so I printed the old Frank Herbert books. And Brian told me last year that the royalty checks that we're sending them makes WordFire Press the number four income-generating publisher for the Frank Herbert estate worldwide.
Wow, that's impressive.
And we're like, well, these were just sitting there earning nobody any money at all. And then so I redid a bunch of Brian's old out-of-print science fiction books. And they're doing so well, we've again made him like three times what the old publisher made him in the first place. And then he decided that he doesn't necessarily like going with big publishers that will keep your rights forever and they won't necessarily promote it. And so he gave me three of his brand new original never before published books that we just published. And he hawks them himself and sells them at conventions. And it's a whole different paradigm. I mean, I'm going on and on, but I'm very enthusiastic about this.
Sure. Well, it's very important. I mean, this is really a paradigm shift in the way that people are approaching, or authors are approaching, publishing, you know, more so than chasing down a publisher, chasing down even self-publish. It's a great new opportunity.
Well, and we do all of our stuff. It's out on Kindle, it's on Kobo, it's on Nook, it's on iBooks, it's on Smashwords, which is sort of a catch-all for all the other formats. And we do print versions of all of our stuff so that you can have a nice copy to hold and show your mom. But, I mean, I'm really getting enthusiastic, but I do want to put a caveat that I have been working in the professional publishing industry for like 30 years.
Right.
I do have graphic design experience. I do know how to design a book. I do know about typesetting.
You're also an established name.
Right.
Let's not discount that. I mean, this is not a nobody coming in with no history. You guys have back history. Well, you have
more importantly, the books are professionally produced books.
Right.
And that's really the key. Whether you have the experience, because I had the same sort of typesetting experience coming out of the game industry and that sort of thing. Whether you have our level of experience and do it yourself, or you hire a book designer to do it for you, the key is that it is a professionally produced book.
Yeah, because we've all seen truly dreadful looking self-published books.
And, we just had that conversation. Yes.
But I keep thinking of myself, WordFire, as, well, we're just this little press doing some of my other stuff. But we just did a count. We now have about 160 titles up.
Wow.
Yeah, that's great.
And now, of course, we're in the flip side, the nightmare side of it, because it's June. We're supposed to pay royalties to our authors. And now we're just like banging our heads, because trying to collate all of these numbers from Kindle and all these numbers from Kobo and all these numbers from Nook, and they're not all in the same format, and they cover different time periods, and some of them report their sales in the foreign currency in a foreign country, so you have to convert that. And so it's an accounting nightmare, which we are trying to train other people. But I do want to, this will kind of close it, because it's a real clincher, because two of my writing students from Writers of the Future were Jay Lake and Ken Scholes.
Right.
Both went on to become quite successful authors, selling multiple books to Tor Books. And they collaborated on a big novel together called Metatropolis, big future Pacific Northwest city thing. And Jay, his name might be familiar to a lot of your listeners, but Jay had terminal cancer, and he was very public about blogging and describing to everybody about his long ordeal through chemotherapy and radiation therapy and this treatment and that treatment, and he just kept getting worse and worse, and he knew he was terminal. And he told me probably like 8 months ago or so, he said, "I'm not going to live beyond June 2014.
Ooh.
And he and Ken had just written this book, and Ken talked to me this last March and was looking at WordFire, and there was no way, and I mean this, there was absolutely no way any traditional publisher was going to get this book published before Jay died. And so they gave it to me. I said, "We'll do it. We can get it out. We'll make it something you'll be proud of." And they gave me the finished manuscript. I got my team together. We put it through production. We had printed, finished, beautiful copies in hand and up for sale 30 days after they gave us the final manuscript. And we got a copy to Jay in hospice, and he got to hold the book in his hand a week and a half before he died.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And he died on June 1st, and he had told me he wasn't going to live beyond June.
Wow.
So when you talk about a paradigm shift, if you had gone to anybody, to Pocket, to Bantam, to Simon & Schuster, and said, "This is the author, he's written this book, he's dying of cancer, he's only got 3 months, can we get the book out?" They wouldn't even get a contract to you in 3 months.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And now,
and so we're lean and fast moving, and we have proofing teams, we have cover designers, it kind of makes me frustrated. I'm what they call a hybrid author. I'm still doing lots of books. I've still got a bunch of books with tour books. They're putting me on tour. We're doing all kinds of stuff for The Dark Between the Stars, and Mentats of Dune was just a New York Times bestseller a couple of months ago from them. We've got another one coming out in August. So I'm still got lots of stuff and lots of good things to say about the traditional publishers, because they do things that I can't. But there are times when I turn in a book, and I know that I could be selling copies of it tomorrow, but it just sits on an editor's desk and goes through the production for 2 years in New York. And you got to think, I could have been recouping my advance for these 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, the novel by Ken or Jalik and Ken Scholes, that's part of the story bundle. You may want to talk about that just real quick.
Yeah, in fact, that's also one of the sort of like a guerrilla co-op marketing thing that indie authors who control the rights to their books. We've been doing these things. I think I've done 4 or 5 of them, and Mike, you and I have been in a couple of them together.
Yeah.
It's a website or a company called Story Bundle. It's one word, storybundle.com. And it's a bunch of authors that just put their books together in a bundle. And we have a brand new science fiction one called the Cosmic Science Fiction Bundle, because they all have to have corny names. Mm-hmm. The Cosmic Science Fiction Bundle, where it's a like a price line thing. You get all of the books that are there, you name your own price. And it's a minimum of $3, and for $3 you can get 6 novels. And the 6 novels that are on the basic one are the Jay Lake and Ken Scholes book that I just talked about, a brand new story collection by Mike Resnick, a book that I wrote with Doug Beeson called Assemblers of Infinity that was a Nebula nominee, a classic by Frank Herbert called Destination Void, a retrieval artist book by Christine Catherine Rush called Anniversary Day, and a really cool twisted time travel murder mystery called Second Paradigm by Peter Wax, who's our managing editor at WordFire Press, but he's also pretty well known in the collectible card gaming industry. So that $3 or more, you get those 6 books. And if you pay $12, which is the bonus level, then you get 3 more books, including an Anne McCaffrey, Jody Lynn Nye book called Crisis on Duna. That's kind of a classic. I remember reading it quite a while ago. A short science fiction novel called Legion by Brandon Sanderson, a little-known name in the industry.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Mike Stackpole's Perfectly Invisible. So right. You get 9 books for $12.
Wow.
And a piece, I sound like I'm selling you the pocket picture. but again, man, I get enthusiastic about this because this is cool.
It is.
It's $9 for $12 or more. I mean, pay what you feel like, and it's kind of cool to see that a lot of people pay more than they need to make up for people that pay as little as possible. But the average donation is fairly generous, and it comes out. You get all these books, and all the authors cooperate, and they help promote it. And the neat thing is if you're my fan and you buy it because you want to get Assemblers of Infinity, well, you're also getting Mike Stackpole's Perfectly Invisible and Brandon Sanderson's Legion and all these other ones that you might not know who these authors are. And it's a great way for us to, like, co-op everybody else's fans and expose our fans to some other authors that'll do well. And the kicker on it is a good chunk of the money goes to Jay Lake's Chosen Cancer Research Fund, the Clayton Memorial Medical Fund. And so far, since yesterday, it went live yesterday, and in one day they've raised $1,000 for the cancer fund, and it runs for 3 weeks. So you could tell that this is not something that I'm dragging out and don't want to do. I just think this is really cool. The previous bundle I was in was a fantasy bundle that had Neil Gaiman and David Farland and Tracy Hickman and a bunch of other well-known fantasy authors. That one sold enough copies of each one of those books in 3 weeks that it would have put every single book, all 9 of those books, on the New York Times bestseller list if the New York Times tracked those sales.
Wow.
Yep. Yeah, very cool stuff.
So this is a way for us indie authors to sell books that just nobody's figured it out before.
Mm-hmm.
That we have ways that we have ways. There are options and alternatives for us. I mean, again, I'm still, when I hold The Dark Between the Stars in my hand, I see this gigantic hardcover that I see displays of them at Barnes & Noble, and I have cases that I put out on our table at Denver Comic Con or at Dallas Comic Con. I don't feel like running away from New York Publishing anytime soon, but there are certain books, like the Jay Lake one, that aren't appropriate for New York Publishing.
Yeah.
And reprinting all these old Frank Herbert books that, look, we tried. We tried to get the regular publisher to print them, and they just weren't interested because the numbers didn't work. Well, I don't have a skyscraper in Manhattan and 7,000 employees, so I can probably produce a book for less upfront investment, and I can make it a viable thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, it is. It's all about overhead. I mean, that's really the piece that... that makes you're more streamlined. You're able to do a lot more because of that.
Well, and I like to be able to say, yes, I'm the publisher of WordFire Press. Even though I've had 54 bestsellers and I'm in 30 different languages and I've, you know, done rather well for myself as a writer, I compare myself to Ron Howard. I feel like I started out as little Opie on Mayberry RFP, and I became very well known as Richie Cunningham, but now I'm like Academy Award winning director Ron Howard, and it's just when I hold it, it's funny because I spend more time at these at Denver Comic Con and things grabbing one of the books that I published and said, look at this, look what I did. It's just a matter of pride, and I'm just so tickled that it can be done because I grew up, I wanted to be a writer since I was 5 years old, so I always looked at publishing and looked at books as a magical thing almost, that this is, you know, if you're a kid who wants to throw baseball back and forth, you look at pro baseball players as the gods of the industry. And I still look at Bantam books and Tor books and Simon and Schuster as, wow, they're the powerful, magical people who make books appear into bookstores, and wow, I'm doing that now. I mean, we're putting it through the system. I'm doing one or two at a time. I'm not doing 10,000 copies that get sent out to Barnes & Noble, but still, it's a book that we produced. You know, I'm the proud father of holding up the baby book. And,
yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, I applaud your efforts, and it's definitely something that needs to be, you know, it's sorely needed out there as another avenue, another opportunity.
Well, the thing is, you have to do everything. So the promotion and the business, and like I said before, just this nightmare of doing the royalty statements. If you, our friends, Chris, Dean Catherine Rush, and Dean Wesley Smith also have a very large indie publishing house, but they have, what they decided was they're not publishing anybody else's stuff, only their own books.
Right.
Which means that they don't have to worry about the royalties. They want to track what sells and what doesn't, but they don't need to cut checks at the end of the day. Everything belongs to them. But I have to figure out, well, Mike Stackpole and I've got a series called 5x5, which is five military science fiction novellas written by five military science fiction writers. And so that has to be every 6 months. We have to add up, how many copies did that sell on Nook? How many copies did that sell on Kindle? How many copies did that sell on iBooks? How many copies did that sell on Kobo? And add up, and they're not really huge amounts. You add up, you know, $30 here and $50 there and whatever. And then we need to cut checks and divide it up among everybody and figure out.
Sure.
And people,
yeah, the
people
business end
move, and they don't tell you where they moved, and so then the check comes back. And
the business end always picks it.
Or unfortunately, authors die.
Yeah,
you have to be aware.
Yeah, well,
too. Yeah.
You know, we did. Aaron yep. Alston, our friend and fellow Star Wars author, was in two of the 5x5s, and now and Mike Stackpole has helped me out to know where I send the check now. But that's another little thing that we need to chase around and figure things out. But I'm talking so much about the publishing end, but I'm an author first and foremost, and I know what things that annoyed me as an author when I dealt with publishers. And the thing that all authors are now uptight about is like just trying to get their rights back and trying to get out of contracts they don't like. And I may be kind of stupid and naive here, but I don't want to publish an author who doesn't want to be with my publishing house. And all the contracts that we have, that it's got a 3-year time limit on it. That after 3 years, if you don't like it, then walk away and we shake hands and you're done. And if you like it, then it just rides. But at any point after that, then you can have your rights back and good luck to you.
Wow.
And so far, nobody's wanted to. I mean, that's the thing. If you, I don't want to have an author and refuse to let them go and make them all mad at me because they can't get their rights back and I'm not making much money on them anyway.
Yeah, or offer a service that they actually want and they'll stay around. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, people are fairly sedentary. I mean, once they get comfortable with something it's working and they're a good thing. Yeah, it's inertia. That's
inertia.
It. You bet. That works too.
Well, I figure if I'm sending you checks, I'm making money, you're making money, and you're not doing any work, and we're just basically letting the... Once you get... This is the other cool thing. Once you get a book listed up on Kindle or up on Kobo or whatever, it's there.
Yeah.
It's not like I have to go and restock the eggshells every day in the grocery store. It's there, and the checks will, who knows how big they'll be, but it's still earning. It's kind of the maintenance that I have to do is the accounting, which is a pain in the butt. But it's not like I have a warehouse full of books that I have to pay taxes on, and I don't have to front the printing costs for $10,000 to print enough copies of the book to make it something we can take to trade shows and stuff. So it's, as you can tell, I'm a crusader on this stuff.
I can definitely tell.
Yep. Well, this is...
And Mike Stackpole, you were the one who was lecturing me like this like 3 or 4 years ago. So.
Yeah, I know. And see, I'm glad it took. Because you're writing me checks now. So I like this. But Kevin, this has been great. So I know you get tons of stuff to do, and we've got to get this podcast out, hopefully in time, so people can participate in the storybundle.com.
Absolutely.
Cosmic science fiction bundle. But again, thank you very much, and look forward to seeing the new book.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And it's The Dark Between the Stars and Dan Shamble Zombie PI. Well, if I list them all, we're on for another half an hour.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was going to say, there's a lot of books. We'll have a lot of these links on the website. I'm sure you can go to dragonpage.com. Of course, follow us on Facebook. Go there and like us, please. We're trying to get Facebook to be our communication port where everybody goes and hangs out and chats and does some really cool stuff.
Absolutely.
But, Kevin, awesome talking to you again. And sure we will catch you at some of the other conventions or see you around somewhere.
Really see you at DragonCon.
Absolutely.
All right. See you at DragonCon. Okay. Thanks, Mike and Mike. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All righty, folks. Thanks.